May the words of our mouths, the meditations of our hearts be ever pleasing in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Morning, everyone. It is genuinely good to be here. Thank you to Claire, my dear old friend and person who took me in and gave me refuge, literally shelter at a rough time of my life, which I'm always grateful. And thank you to Andrew for liaising with me and helping put together the service. Andrew and I go back as friends a number of years too. And in fact, true story, Andrew was present the night I met my future wife. So we were all public school chaplains together on a retreat at New North here. And yeah, Andrew and I got a little bit tired of a bit of, how do I say this non-judgmentally? Oh no, today's that prophecy, I'll be judgmental. There was a little bit of crazy, not overly critically minded, charismatic kind of fellowship going on amongst a lot of the chaplains, and Andrew and I were seeking refuge, somewhere to have a quiet conversation, and we ducked into a little side room at St. Gertrude's College, and there sitting was Laura, and it just felt like a moment stuck in my memory. Anyway, I dressed really informally today because it's the last day of my leave for my regular gig as a minister at Wembley Downs Church of Christ. And I came in here, saw Andrew in T-shirt and shorts, thought, I'm home. It's good. There is so much I could have tried to squeeze in today's sermon when Andrew said he wanted to talk about prophets and the prophetic mode. I heard a lot of ideas then in our discussion, particularly the thought about whistleblowers. The whole thing now, our culture of kind of manipulative secrecy dressed up as kind of confidentiality and security, and the way that's used to control people, and the punitive measures towards whistleblowers and prophets, basically within governmental and corporate structures. The active oppression by our government, here in Australia, that we think of as a free nation, you know, the raids on journalists within the last 12 months. Scary times for the truth, for the prophetic mode. Anyway, I didn't try to squeeze all of that into some big thesis today, but I'm glad we have a time for discussion and questions later. So I look forward to that. And let's just make sure that we do use the talking stick, or we will hear another prophetic rage on behalf of our prophet championing those who can't be here today and will need to hear it later. So a few months ago, I was chatting online with an old buddy that I hadn't really spoken with since our early days as stand-up comics in the mid-90s. It was a good talk, us being men now that are hitting that reflective time of midlife, as well as being old comedy comrades who share that unpolished honesty and philosophical curiosity that's characteristic of the trade. It turns out my friend I hadn't spoken to in 20-odd years was most curious about how the young comic he had known back in the day had since got himself tangled up in the Jesus business. His question made me laugh out loud, which was, why religion, though? Were you in a dark place? I still chuckle at that months later. I get his confusion. He was a guy who'd had a horrible time growing up queer amongst Roman Catholicism. He was also a comic by trade. So comics, as a rule, hold truth and freedom as their deepest values. And religion has sadly earned a reputation as controlling people through manipulation of the truth. So it made sense to me that he'd figure the only way I'd give up, as he thought, on truth and freedom by drinking the Kool-Aid of religion was if I'd somehow train-wrecked my life and crawled broken into a place where being told what to think and how to behave was a comfort. I can't remember the earnest answer that I gave him type that night into Messenger, but my immediate thought was, why did I put down the comedy life and follow Jesus? Because I can make more trouble this way. Making trouble is probably not a phrase most Christians would use if expressing their understanding of the spiritual life. If we take our faith seriously, though, that's a pretty solid expression of our call. Know that you're loved, know everything and everyone is loved, attain peace, be peace, then get out there and lovingly mess with the world. My own childhood was traumatic in some ways, both in terms of my personal, social and family circumstances, and at a cultural level by the fact that I was an oversensitive, overthinker of a kid growing up during the Cold War. Reading books like When the Wind Blows and studying the potential of a global nuclear holocaust in primary school social studies did have a big effect on me. I was basically formed at a young age into hopelessness, into understanding peace as only attainable at a personal level, so that you might have serenity when the apocalypse wiped you out. This is probably why I was attracted to Eastern philosophies that emphasised detachment, seeking an inner state of being that was independent to the turmoil of the world. Zen Buddhism and Taoism, at my superficial level of engagement, really appealed to me. The ostensible wisdom of just be cool, man, it is what it is, spoke to my younger self as a healing balm on my existential discomfort. A philosophy like this of just seeing and accepting what's beyond our personal control can really work if our only goal is personal peace of mind. And I reckon this is the big appeal today of the mindfulness movement, that big ticket item of the spiritual commodities market, or Zen light, as a Buddhist nun friend of mine likes to call it. Breathe and let it wash past over you. It's an excellent treatment for anxiety, and in a world where truth and facts are up for grabs, where politics are corrupt and somehow money and power still remain our gods, while the devastating consequences of both capitalism and climate collapsing are being felt right now, in that world, anxiety makes total sense. So if you're feeling anxious at all ever, you are sane. Sane is good. Just choose what you're anxious about. Not so much at whether your boss likes you. More about the way your boss expects staff to work extra hours at home when they should be resting and connecting with family. That's the prophetic mode. Christians right now who should have prophetic speech and action written into our DNA are getting a masterclass in prophetic religion from the Extinction Rebellion movement, who profess no religion but demonstrate plenty. They speak out. They gather and nourish community. They train in nonviolent direct action. They inspire and organise. They hit the streets and witness truth and challenge power and demand justice. They openly use the playbook of Martin Luther King Jr., who openly used the playbook of Jesus of Nazareth. And I reckon Jesus and the prophets of old are smiling. From Luke today, we heard the lyrical, it wasn't read actually, it wasn't referred to. So in Luke today, the assigned reading from Luke is the Song of Zechariah. This is this lyrical and very explicit prophesying by Zechariah. Now, this was not some lovely prayer of thanksgiving from an aging man grateful to be a dad for the first time. Zechariah declares his infant son, John, will be a prophet of the Most High. Geez, no pressure, son. And being the prophet of the Most High won't mean preaching at some Billy Graham-style crusades. It will mean going before the one from the house of David who will save us from our enemies and the hands of all who hate us. And saving us from hate, in Zechariah's context, is not vaguely equivalent to the call from some Christians in our society today to be protected from criticism and the consequences of our words. In Zechariah's context, being saved from those who hate you is literally a matter of life and death. It's literally a matter of power and powerlessness, literally a matter of light and darkness. And it is a total table flip on business as usual. It's not a call to an uprising to install yet another new order of control by authority of violence, but it's a revolution into a, quote, way of peace. The stakes could not be higher here. The road for John the prophet will be treacherous, ending with his head cut off for the most arbitrary of reasons. Prophets are rarely honoured and thanked in their lifetimes. It's not a gig with a solid retirement plan. It's going all in to the agony of the cross. From an earlier bit of the big book today, we did hear the prophet Jeremiah speaking on behalf of God, "Woe to the shepherds who destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture," says the Lord. Now, in that context, Jeremiah the Benjamite had specific beef with priests and leaders of the Davidic line in Jerusalem. But for us today, we don't have to look hard for shepherds who destroy and scatter today. Here in Australia, in Britain, in the USA, society has been led from neoliberalism to a place very much that's beginning to look like neo-fascism. And this destructive new authoritarianism scatters us by confusion, misinformation, and media distraction. We've moved from the dangers of tribal morality into the absolute madness of tribal epistemology. So knowledge and truth is up for grabs now. And knowledge and truth itself has become a weapon of polarisation. What sources do you listen to? What's a fact now? A fact is a debatable thing. So tribal epistemology means you think like I think and you accept what I accept and you dismiss what I dismiss, or you're not one of us. And now, ridiculously, the pressure is totally off the bad shepherds to have to present us with a cogent narrative. They only need to make sure the marketplace of ideas is flooded with conspiracies and doubts and competing narratives that we sheep will scatter ourselves while Mark Zuckerberg sits back and counts his Rolexes. So maybe you're not up for getting arrested or losing your job or getting beheaded in your own vocation as a prophet for Jesus. And that's okay. Because perhaps the most needed prophetic activity today is to witness to the truth, to wisdom, to reason founded on the good of all. So take your troubled soul and open your eyes, embrace your bleeding heart, and take a daily stand for the reign of justice and grace in the world. And believe me, that will make trouble enough. Folks, if I may, how are we going with time, Andrew? I've got a couple of minutes. Time to...
You got plenty.
Got plenty? Okay, all right.
We're here till one.
We're here till Thursday. Woo! Strap in, folks. No, I just wanted to... I saw a lovely thing on social media, which I've just been damning and critiquing up here. On Facebook, what's more. There's my hypocrisy as a prophet. But it's a beautiful piece of liturgical writing specifically for the Feast of Christ the King, or the Reign of Christ, as you may call it. Not so much a prayer, I think, as a prophetic exhortation, written by a fellow called Steve Ganass Holmes. "For the Feast of Christ the King, renounce the hope that in the second coming Christ will act more like Caesar than Jesus of Nazareth. God meant it the first time, and it will be no different. The cross is not God's B game. God comes among us, not conquering, but asking for love. Christ lures us away from supremacy. Christ is an outcast, whomever we reject or despise, to heal us of our resistance to love. Christ is homeless, a refugee, a migrant. Christ is black, queer, alien. The only barrier between us and heaven is the limit of our love. God comes as the other and asks us to love, and the kingdom comes no sooner than we see her and love her. The second coming has come a million times, and we keep missing it." Beautiful. So, filled with love, filled with grace, and that it's a little bit of that prophetic edge, challenging us all, I think, in all the right ways, like Jesus challenged us. Questions? Yeah, I think we should. Yeah.
One, two.
Thanks for that. I like your expression about making trouble. I think Jesus made a lot of trouble when he was around on earth, and I think he continues to make trouble. My image of Jesus is a very disturbing person who said things that make people feel uncomfortable when they need to be made uncomfortable. And I think Christians have lost that art in many cases.
Yeah, thank you. I have a wonderful woman in my congregation who I won't name, but she's a brilliant thing, and she does so much I would call prophetic work out in the community. And she's always apologising, I think, because she grew up in a nice, polite, good Christian household. She's always apologising for not being nice. I'm sorry I'm not nice, Paul. I'm sorry I'm not nice. And I'm always saying to her, who told you you need to be nice, you know? You have such a fierce, burning love, which is tempered with your warmth and your kindness and your passion for people and to do good for all. Where did nice come from? Like, what part of Jesus was nice? Yes, love, yes, healing, grace, forgiveness. But this idea of niceness, anyway, is such a kind of a... it's a strange concept. So, yeah, that thing about making trouble. Does anyone here know the wonderful Willie Nelson song about Jesus, the troublemaker? Oh, seriously, go home and Google it. It's a beautiful, like, Willie Nelson, old, you know, rebel pothead, and he wrote this love song to Jesus, basically, called The Troublemaker. And I won't try to sing it and scare you all, but it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. Yes?
Feels like a challenge is that we can find ourselves creating enemies by wanting to follow a charismatic leader that we see as a prophet. Mm-hmm. And then Jesus comes along and tells us to love our enemies. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about the loved enemy.
Yeah, I think there's a whole bunch of really interesting stuff in there. Because we are living in an age of demagoguery. And as I talked about tribal morality and tribal epistemology, and there's a lovely fellow in my congregation at the moment who is so engaged with me in a war about... he's a climate change skeptic. And and I've tried to kind of... because we get on really well and like we work together and whatever else, I've just said... I've tried to play the kind of middle ground with him and say, look, I'm not a scientist, you're not a scientist, you know... we could debate this till the cows come home, but, you know, I'm kind of convinced by the scientific evidence, although, you know, and you're not. You subscribe to your news sources, I subscribe to mine. Who knows who's wrong? He's like, no, not good enough. And he really wants us to kind of debate every last thing out. And for him, it's such a thing of that thing of, are you with me or against me? You know, and he talks about the climate brigade, the same way that people would say the gay agenda, as if there's this big kind of, you know, group of people out there trying to manipulate it for a certain kind of cause. So demagoguery is an absolute problem. And I've reflected many times, and in preparation for this sermon, that you can't really prophesy from a throne. You can't. There's a reason why prophets are on the margins. There's a reason why Jesus' throne was a cross and his crown was thorns. And I think any prophet in the modern world, at least, worth his or her salt, comes with a kind of humility, comes from a place of, I'm no better or worse than you, I'm just as flawed, as broken as anyone, but here's what I see, here's what I believe, here's what the Holy Spirit is moving through me. As soon as a prophet looks slick, I'm so glad I'm in a church today that was not slick, because we confuse polish and slick and glamorous these days with authority, right? But, you know, John the Baptist, Jeremiah, Jesus of Nazareth, these people didn't get around slick, and it was the message, ultimately. And I think Christianity... we've gone a little too far in turning Jesus into an object of worship rather than a teacher, rather than a master, rather than a prophet we listen to, who stirs us to act in our own lives. But yes, we need to be very, very careful. We need to listen to the message and ask what our own work will be, rather than going, yep, I'm on Richard Rohr's team, and if you insult him, then you've had a go at me somehow. It's not that at all, I don't think.
I'm sitting with the troublemaker piece too, but I'm thinking the things I've put together or sitting with is it's about the prophetic presence of Jesus before the words. And I'm thinking both what I love about Jesus in the gospel is the people he gets stuck into are the leaders, etc. And then the people he is compassionate to but challenging to are the outcasts.
Absolutely.
And I'm putting it together with, because I think it's about our presence in the world. So I do a lot of work in organisations around courageous leadership and about supporting people to reconnect soul with role. And what I experience most workplaces as places of chaos and pressure and madness. And I have the luxury of dipping in and out of them because I'm self-employed. But what I find people are hungry for hospitable places where we treat each other as human beings. And so supporting people to create... So it's not about haranguing people to do that. It's about creating... another leadership writer talks about creating islands of sanity. So I'm sitting with it. It's not a... I think the image of the prophet is sort of the angry prophet as opposed to the prophetic presence, I suppose, what I'm playing with, which is courageous enough to be able to speak the truth, but it's about inviting people into a different space.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really interesting. And I agree that which is the point I tried to come home on, the prophetic mode is just standing witness to the truth, to calm, to peace. I think prophetic presence, you know, that presence of witness is such a powerful thing. Like, you know, I think I could certainly mount an argument that Mother Teresa of Calcutta was a prophet, not for any words she said in sort of as a public theologian or moralist or spiritualist, but for the witness of the way she devoted her life to the work she did. And not through any self-promotion, that story and that image of her work with the poorest and lowest, you know, in the slums of Calcutta became a story around the world that spoke to people on a deep level. So, yeah, I think there's a kind of prophetic witness and presence that is far beyond shouting angrily into a megaphone, although that is some people's gift. I would agree. I don't think the Kingdom of Dawn is going to be realised for all by people shouting into megaphones. That's the change I think you're talking about, that island of sanity, when the world is an island of sanity and peace and grace. So thank you.
I'm interested in exploring different models of being a prophet. Our biblical model is a single male voice, and what I'm wondering about is I think occasionally I might get an impulse to think I really should speak out about something, but I know that sometimes I don't word things well, or I upset people because I went about it the wrong way, and it has a limited life because I can't get the impetus. So what I'm wondering about is, what about shared prophetic voice, you know, sort of getting a little group alongside you to test you out and to help guide you, those sorts of models. I wonder if more of that could be helpful.
That's really interesting. My brain really got caught up in the first part of what you were saying about the biblical model of kind of male prophets and leaders, and I think that's a... I don't know if it's so much that the female prophets aren't in the Bible so much as we've been trained as a culture over a couple thousand years to not see them or regard them that way. And I just wanted to say what's probably obvious to all of us who read the Bible at any level is that. So in Luke's gospel, Mary's Magnificat, the kind of the song that she says in response to finding out that she's pregnant with the Messiah, is I mean, that is hardcore prophecy. That's the rich will be sent away empty and the hungry will be filled. That's subversive and political, and it's not just this flowery kind of heavenly sort of language. It's boom, God is coming and the powerful better watch out. So that to me is one of the strongest passages of prophecy in the Bible from the mouths of Mary. I also think about the fact that in all versions of the Synoptic Gospels, it's women who are the first to witness the resurrection. It's the women like Mary Magdalene who are the first to come back from the tomb going, he's gone, he's risen. So I think it's all over the scripture. I just think we've gotten very good at, we just love a dude in a beard. Whether it's God, in our kind of classic Monty Python style art, whether it's Jesus, whether it's Moses, Jeremiah, whoever. As far as, and I think we have a massive cultural problem of, we have, and it's still ongoing, where my wife and I talk about this a lot, Laura, my co-minister, that women are still raised, girls are still raised to be more compliant, agreeable, to be able to get into a confrontation by being kind of, by negotiating and compromising rather than kind of standing their ground. We're kind of better at encouraging our boys to, no, stick up for yourself. In a kind of a, so I think it's still a problem in our culture that women kind of have to learn assertiveness by a much more kind of subtle nuanced kind of relational art form. Whereas men are given far more license, especially white men in our culture, to step into a room and go, right, I'm talking, everyone's listening. Thank goodness I had to work for a long time in Aboriginal ministry where I found out that is the worst possible thing you can do amongst Aboriginal people. Step into the room and go, all eyes on me. That's nonsense to them. So I am giving a long-winded answer that is not directly answering, I think, your very good question about getting together and support. I think that's a... I think the idea of a peer group of women coming together and exploring... What's that?
I didn't say women.
You didn't say women? No, I'm sorry.
Particularly men who might have a tendency to just get up and speak first, mm-hmm. and think later. the benefit of checking out and having a test group around you before going public, I don't think is something just women need. I think any individual, so that my comment about the women was a side issue, the real issue is... what is a more useful and adult way to approach being a voice?
I completely agree with you. I would say, for example, that Donald Trump needs far more people around him before he tweets. but yes, generally speaking, I also want to say that alongside that very wise suggestion is that sometimes the prophetic mode means you will have to be the fool. And you will have to be the one that everyone goes, no, don't say that. You're off the... No, whoa. And that, to a degree, is sometimes the loneliness of the prophet.
Can I just respond to what Jenny said, that I think Paul, in 1 Corinthians, if I remember rightly, gave a very clear... set of guidelines, which is let two or three prophets speak, let others weigh what is said. So it's not a matter of saying, oh, that's the prophet, it must be true. You know, you're spending time in community, praying about it and reflecting on it.
Yeah, thank you.
I was just wondering if Israel Folau, that's how you say it, he could have done with a group.
Yeah, well, and we shouldn't open that can of worms, but there would be a whole bunch of Christians saying he is a prophet.
Well, I'll do that too.
So you know, it's a very, again, it's a polarizing, and no doubt he's making trouble. So perhaps from my definition this morning, he is. So it's a very, very, I don't know how many of us have been involved with the Pentecostal church at some point where it's members of the church consider it like a completely legit thing to walk up to you and say, I've got a word from God for you. And drop this kind of truth on you, like it's unmediated from heaven. The idea that the Holy Spirit can speak to any of us and then we get to speak on behalf of God, it's a potent, dangerous business. And for me, the idea that in the 21st century, a man can say, the most devastating bushfires in Australian history are currently happening, where people are currently dying, currently losing property, currently suffering, is because God's angry at equal marriage. The idea that anyone can hear that and then go, oh, but he's just expressing his religious beliefs. Anyway, sorry, that's my little bit of anger.
I was going to say, in my dark moments, I've read some of the comments that have come after the... I know. And look, there's a proportion of some Christians saying that he is a modern-day prophet and that he's being treated in a certain way, and there are some sectors that do support him as that demagoguery, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, again, I have some anger over this whole thing, so I'm sorry if my scepticism here is starting to fall into what sounded like cynicism. But for me, Israel Folau, for whom the Australian Christian lobby is still gathering millions of dollars for his legal defence fund, and he is sitting currently on a property portfolio post rugby worth about $7 million. It's not what we'd call prophecy in the Old Testament road. That's what I'm trying to say. Sorry, the bitterness is creeping out. But love in.
That's right. By the time we've edited the tape, you won't recognise that. We might have one more, if that's okay, and then we might wrap up.
Yeah. I liked... Jenny reminded me of this idea of, you know, when you speak and how to speak, and people who are shy and people who are used to speaking. And a lot of the work I've done over the years now in men's support groups and things is that with a group of guys who have been meeting for over 20 years. So we started off as midlife crisis refugees, helping each other with that. And now they're running universities and big businesses, and they've resolved all those things. So now they're the person in their group that people go to when they've got a problem. And the whole... this is a bit long-winded, but you'll get it. Our time is often spent now with that because of the absolute confidentiality and the acceptance. So we listen, we don't argue, we don't advise. We just provide the opportunity to think out loud amongst a trusted cohort. And time and time again, we'll come with something that's really got us steamed up, and it might be at work. And just blast all that out, and then gradually start talking sense to yourself. And you calm down, you take the emotional charge off it, and then the logic kicks in. And then you meet a fortnight later, how did that go? Well, I just went in there and I talked sense and they got it. You know? So that's how a group like this can use that to take the charge off, where we don't say, oh, you're not making sense right now. Just let it rip, and eventually you will start making sense to yourself, and then go out there and make a difference.
Yeah.
So that I didn't think about that before, but Jenny made me think about it.
Yeah.
And the idea of not just sticking yourself out there as a target with your emotion in full blast, waiting to get shot down, it doesn't make sense.
Mm.
Cunning as a snake, gentle as a dove.
Yeah, yeah.
Shake the dust off your sandals. Move on. There are people who want to know.
Yeah, sorry. No, that's a beautiful, for me, affirmation of, yeah, following on from Jenny about as you've made there, about spiritual community. You know, the place where we can be honest.
Just a very quick word. I'm only hearing about half of what's going on because of the reverberation and so on. But as I listen to this, I think I want to just throw this in before we close, and that is that I think I'm not sure that troublemaking is the right picture, but I think we are called to be a disturbing presence in the community where we live.
Yeah, thank you. Disruption is a very trendy term right now.